Forward. So welcome back to one and all. Wonderful to have the opportunity to do a little learning with you tonight. If you have the source sheet from last week, it's just as good as having the source sheet from this week. It is one and the same. And we're going to pick up where we left off last time, just to kind of refresh your memory or catch everyone up to speed. We left off in circa 1896, after the publication of the most important book of Herzl's professional career, which was Der Judenstaat. And we talked about the kind of, you know, different reactions, you know, the Chaim Weizmann on the one hand, who had smuggled in a copy in Russia and felt like this was just such a breath of fresh air. And what a vision that Herzl spelled out and gave, you know, Russian Jews this new sense of hope and self-determination on the one hand, and then the kind of description that Stefan Zweig described on the other. What's happening here? We knew Herzl as an enlightened German-speaking Jew, and he was writing for the most prominent newspaper in Vienna, and now he starts talking about these wild fantasies of a Jewish homeland. You're setting us back. What do we need a homeland for? We're already at home. So these are the kind of poles that we can think about when we think about the reaction to Herzl's Der Judenstaat. Okay. So I want to transition for a moment and talk about what happened next for Herzl and his plan to make Der Judenstaat into a reality and create a movement where Zionism could gain enough momentum to finally arrive at a homeland, at a promised land. So among the people who read this book and who are excited by this book is a man called Reverend William Heckler, H-E-C-H-L-E-R, who at the time was an Anglican minister to the British Embassy in Vienna. He had written his own book about the return of Jews to Palestine in keeping with the words of the prophets and the hope of a second coming and so on, according to his theology. And Herzl and he met. And this was the beginning of really the next 8 years of Herzl's life, where he made every possible effort to connect to anyone who he could possibly get an audience with to try to plead his case for how to move this project forward. And if you read the diaries, and again, thousands of pages, but you can read them, they're translated in English. You know, he's always on a train. He's always traveling. He doesn't get a meeting with this one, but somebody else was in town, so he got a meeting with that one. And that's his whole existence for these next 8 years. So what I want to share with you are a couple of pieces of this project, how they turned into the series of Zionist congresses, the next book that I mentioned, Alte Neuland, and then the legacy of Herzl, with which we'll conclude. Okay. So back to our friend, William Heckler. Herzl says, who can you get me an audience with? Can you get me an audience with the German Kaiser? Okay, I have a plan for him. So eventually, Heckler arranges a meeting with Frederick I, who's the Grand Duke of Baden, in April 1896, who in turn set up a meeting between Herzl and the Kaiser. They actually met more than once. The most famous meeting was on the only trip that Herzl ever took to Palestine in 1898. There's a famous picture, it's actually doctored, of the Kaiser on a horse and Herzl meeting him. They met at Mikveh Israel. It's a true story, and the meeting was true, but the camera malfunctioned. They didn't get a picture of this. They staged some kind of picture in its place. You can Google it and find the whole story. They met at Mikveh Israel, which was the settlement that had been founded by Zvi Hirsch Kalischer's group that we talked about a couple weeks ago. And Herzl's proposal in meeting with German officials was to create a German outpost in Palestine. And the response was kind of always the response that Herzl got, which was, you know, there's some merit to the idea, and the Germans would kind of be happy to ship off some or all of their Jews to Palestine, but nothing really came of it. Herzl started meeting with statesmen to try to convince the next, right? If it wasn't going to be the Germans, what about the Ottomans? Maybe the Ottomans could create a Jewish homeland. And what Herzl's plan was that the Ottomans would give Jews a charter to create a Jewish homeland in Palestine in exchange for payment of Turkey's debt. Okay, so the whole idea was quite convoluted, but the idea was that a syndicate of Jews, you know, Jewish bankers who have lots of money, over the course of 3 years would buy debt bonds and basically ameliorate the debt of the Turks, and the Sultan would grant a charter to the Jews to settle in Palestine. Okay. Herzl drummed up almost no interest, you know, for anyone to go ahead with this plan, not really from the Ottomans and not really from the Jews. Concurrently, while he's busy meeting with any statesman who will give him an audience, he began to organize the first Zionist conference. Okay, because he recognized, as we talked about last week, this wasn't going to happen as a solo project, but he needed a group, he needed a committee, he needed allies to be able to move this project forward. So he organizes the first Zionist Congress. Where's the first Zionist Congress? Takes place in Basel, Switzerland. So that everybody knows, but where was it supposed to take place? Okay, this is an amazing footnote in history. So the first Zionist Congress takes place in Basel. It was supposed to take place in Munich, but it didn't take place in Munich, and here's why. There was too much opposition. And I'll just share with you, this is source number 8 on your sheet. This is a letter written by the Executive Committee of the Association of German Rabbis. Germans like long titles, so that I think it's probably all one word in German. Executive Committee for the Association of German Rabbis, representation primarily of Reform rabbis, but also some Orthodox, some traditional rabbis. And look what they say. You want to have your Zionist Congress in Munich? We object. This is an amazing letter. The Association of Rabbis in Germany regards it as proper to make the following explanations. Number one, the efforts of so-called Zionists to found a Jewish national state in Palestine contradict the messianic promises of Judaism as contained in Holy Writ and in later religious sources. You can't create a Jewish state until the Messiah comes. So what are you doing? And number two, and this is really extraordinary, Judaism obligates an adherence to serve with all devotion the fatherland to which they belong and to further its national interest with all their heart and with all their strength. Religion and patriotism both lay upon us the duty of asking all who are concerned with the welfare of Judaism to stay away from the above-mentioned Zionist endeavors, and most particularly from the Congress, which is still being planned despite all the warnings against it. It's not just they don't want the Congress to happen, and you know, they're not just objecting to the Congresses taking place in Germany, they're objecting to the entire notion of the Congress taking place at all. It's antithetical to everything we German rabbis stand for, right? Talk about putting the cart before the horse. We're supposed to be patriots, and we're supposed to care about the fatherland, and we're supposed to be good citizens. Shkoach, that's all true. But you think that's more important than saving worldwide Jewry from anti-Semitism and founding a Jewish state, right? It's amazing, right? The inversion of priorities, but they win, right? And they, because of their objections, the history will always record that the first Zionist Congress took place in Basel and not in Munich. I put for you on the source sheet, and I'm sorry it came out a little small and not so enlargeable, but I did find a copy. I don't know how many there are in existence, but a copy of an invitation to the first Zionist Congress in 1897. There, you know, several hundred people were invited, so there's several hundred invitations that went out. And you could read in the Hebrew. And again, it's before Hebrew was really a spoken language, but it invites the recipient of this invitation to this gathering, which will take place in Basel, And it'll be a victorious day when our movement is able to finally coalesce into the beginning of something larger. And I'll just note at the bottom, this stunning line, it says, Anu mekavim shetedu et chovatchem v'tavol la'asifatenu. We hope that you understand your obligation and join us at this gathering. Ba'asifa efshar yeh ledaber ivrit. Bebazel yesh achsanya ksheira. And by the way, just letting you know what language you're going to speak. This is an international convention. So I don't know. Does everyone coming speak German? Does everyone coming speak Russian? So he says, you could speak in Hebrew. That's going to be fine. And by the way, you should just know there's a kosher hotel in Basel. That shouldn't be an obstacle for anyone, right? It's like you get the invitation to the Federation dinner and it says, you know, dietary laws strictly observed. So first Zionist Congress, kosher food is available. Okay. And I think I put for you on the source sheet just a rendering of what the Congress looked like. It was very important, and this is for a different conversation, it was very important for Herzl that everyone looked the part. So, you know, we're taking ourselves seriously. Herzl always took himself seriously. He always dressed like a statesman, even though he wasn't representing a state that existed yet. So it's the three-piece suit, and it's the tails and the tie and the whole getup, and that was required attire for everyone in attendance. This is not schlocky. This is serious. If we want the world to take us seriously, then we have to look the part. Okay. So what happened at the first Zionist Congress? Did they actually accomplish anything? So I want to just share with you, again, it's always, I think, very telling to read the contemporaneous reports of what happened, not just the, you know, historical accounts from someone looking back with the grand sweep of history. How did this matter? What did they think of it the day after? So Reuben Asher Broudis was writing, was an attendee, and he wrote the following in Hamagid, which was one of the popular newspapers, periodicals at the time. And he wrote the following. He says, the Congress was like a wonderful dream, a fabulous divine spectacle. And again, anyone attending was, you know, had drunk the Kool-Aid and they were rooting for it to be successful. So it's not an impartial observer. But he says it was like a wonderful dream, a fabulous divine spectacle. It was an extraordinary event. And this is the key line. It was an extraordinary event, not because it arrived at any great decisions, witnessed any great debates, or produced any great insights, but in and of itself, it's enough for our people to know that it now has something to hope for, that it still has the will to live, that it has taken its future into its hands. So I think that's, you know, maybe the most apt description here. And I'll come back in a second to what it did accomplish. But even if it accomplished nothing politically, even if it accomplished nothing as, you know, as far as moving the Zionist project forward, just the fact that it happened was for its participants and for everyone rooting for its success in and of itself a success, right? Which I think is important to note, that we could get together, we could formulate an agenda, we could meet each other, we could give each other a sense of encouragement and chizuk, even if there was nothing tangible that came out of it. But there was something tangible that came out of it. So at the Congress, they formulated what they called the Basel Program, which was a Zionist platform for the first time. There was the foundation of the Zionist organization. The national anthem of Hatikva was adopted at the first Zionist Congress. We had talked about the kind of Chovevei Tzion societies or the Zionist societies that had sprung up by the dozens all over Europe. So now there's an umbrella under which they can all be subsumed. And the Congress elected Herzl as president of the Zionist organization, which itself would be important for the future of the movement. Okay. And again, it's hard to measure success, but just to give you one statistic, which I think is telling, at the time of the first Zionist Congress in 1897, there were roughly 100 Zionist groups in Europe. By the following year, there were 900. So you know, now there's an address, now there's an umbrella organization, now there's a movement, and you have something you can join. I'm not just, joining my local club, but I can attach myself and I can attach my allegiance to something much larger. Okay, and that's a big deal. Maybe the most famous quote of Herzl, other than, Im Tirtzu, Ein Zo Agadah, is he said, at Basel, I founded the Jewish state. If I were to say this today, I would be greeted by universal laughter in 1897. In 5 years, perhaps, and certainly in 50, everyone will see it. Okay, and almost a perfect prediction. 50 years later, 1947, you have partition. 1948, you have Declaration of Independence. So it's really extraordinary, to think about the prophetic nature of Herzl. It's almost not an exaggeration. So things begin to build. By the next year, in 1898, the second Zionist Congress, you grow from, I forgot the number of the first one. Did I say a number? How many delegates to the first one? I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me. It was 100 plus. By the second Zionist Congress, you have 349 delegates, including Chaim Weizmann and Moses Gaster. In the intervening Congresses, you have the birth of the Jewish National Fund to buy land in Palestine and, a furtherance of the movement. By 1902, searching for new ideas, because nothing is sticking, Herzl suggested that maybe a Jewish land could be founded in Cyprus or in the Sinai. So we all know about Uganda, but there were other suggestions along the way. The idea was to convince the British to set up a colony in Al-Arish. The Egyptians and the British ultimately rejected the plan. But again, Herzl was grasping at straws. And you can imagine there were people who were unwilling, what I mean by people, delegates of the Zionist Congress with skin in the game. There were delegates who were unwilling to part with the idea of reestablishing a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. And there were those who said, at some point, we have to deal with the problem before us. And, if we could move the project forward incrementally, even if we can't get back to Palestine now, let's not let perfection be the enemy of the good. Maybe we can find some interim solution. 1902, Herzl published Altneuland, which was a novel. So it's fictitious, but it also reveals something about Herzl's vision. And the vision is utopian, peace between Arabs and Jews, a third way between capitalism and socialism. Herzl envisioned some kind of new society that would rise in the land of Israel on a cooperative basis, utilizing science and technology in the development of the land in a way that had never been dreamt of before. And again, I titled this whole series The Zionists, the subtitle of which, Portraits of the Jews Whose Dreams We Live Today, right? So the idea that Israel in the 21st century would be a leader in technology and a leader in innovation. So Herzl had already planted these seeds with Altneuland in 1902. He called it a palace of peace. He said a palace of peace would be built in Jerusalem to arbitrate international disputes. At the same time, the temple would rebuilt on modern principles. Herzl didn't envision that the Jewish inhabitants of the state would be religious per se, but there was respect for religion in the public sphere. And he made no assumption about the language that would be spoken. There was no assumption that Hebrew would be the main language of the land. I'll just share with you one quote. He said, it's founded on the ideas which are a common product of all civilized nations. It would be immoral if we would exclude anyone, whatever his origin, his descent, or his religion from participating in our achievements, for we stand on the shoulders of other civilized people, right? So it's a Jewish state, but open to all. What we own, we owe to the preparatory work of other peoples. Therefore, we have to repay our debt. There is only one way to do it, the highest tolerance. Our motto must therefore be, now and ever, man, you are my brother. Okay, so again, utopian and the fellowship of mankind being the dominating spirit of this utopia. Okay. Let me pause here and just ask if there are any questions before I come to 1903 and then 1904. Okay, so what happens in 1903? What happens in 1903? 1903 is the year of the Kishinev pogrom. So the Kishinev pogrom, in and of itself, you know, proportionately with the benefit of history, is a small-scale pogrom, right? We talk about hundreds of thousands of Jews killed in Ukrainian pogroms in the interwar period. We talk about 6 million Jews murdered by the Nazis during the Holocaust. So how many Jews died in Kishinev? 45 Jews are murdered, and 1,500 Jewish shops and homes are destroyed. So I don't want to minimize anything. Any loss of life, any loss of Jewish life is a tragedy. You know, the scale could not be appreciated with the benefit of looking back over the grand sweep of the bloody 20th century. So 45 Jews are murdered, and they're murdered very brutally. And it gets the attention of the entire world. And I just want to share with you, I did a little editing because it's actually too graphic to even say the words of some of the atrocities that were committed in Kishinev. If you're interested, you Google it. It's all right there. But I'll just share with you one account. This is the New York Times. Okay. And the New York Times picks this up from other newspapers that are reporting. In source number 12, May 16th, 1903. The mob, it is declared, behaved like savages, not killing the victims because they defended their property, but murdering after robbing. The non-Jewish St. Petersburg paper, the Novosti, says the pen is powerless to write all the atrocities committed by the bloodthirsty mob, which spared neither young nor old, women nor children. Many Jews sought refuge with Christians, but in several cases shelter was denied them. The Jews concealed themselves in all manner of places whence they were dragged out and killed outright or crippled. The Vita Musti of St. Petersburg says that a Jewish carrier who took a corpse to the hospital was a quarter of an hour later himself brought there dead. Editorially, the Jewish Chronicle says that if there is any Christianity in Christian Europe, every country should ring with denunciation of the savage government which has put the deeds of the Kurds and the Bashi Bazooks in the shade, adding, "We charge the Russian government with responsibility for the Kishinev massacre. We say it is steeped to the eyes in the guilt of this Holocaust. If Europe does not disassociate itself from the leprous taint of this barbarian power, it writes its humanity down as a sham, its civilization as organized hypocrisy." Now, I'll just open a parenthesis here because I think it's so stunning that this would happen. But, you know, if you go back to the sources, so you always find fascinating things. So right under this New York Times article where the paper describes the atrocities of Kishinev, so there's a short piece that follows. You ready for this? The piece is called, it's special to the New York Times, "Appeal by Chicago's Mayor." May 15th, Mayor Harrison. Okay, I forgot his first name. He's the Mayor Harrison Jr. And it's like Chicago politics. His father was the mayor for 5 terms, and he was the mayor for 5 terms. They never had a mayor. Wasn't named Harrison for 50 years or something. So I don't know of any connection he has to the Jewish community. Look what he writes. "Mayor Harrison has issued the following appeal in the form of a proclamation." This is the New York Times. I don't know why they're picking up a Chicago mayor. "To the people of Chicago. The people of this country, regardless of creed, are shocked by the reports of cruelties to Jews in Russia, which in these civilized times are almost beyond belief. It is unnecessary at present to fix the blame or to attach the responsibility for these atrocities. It is not, however, too soon to relieve the survivors. After the loss of children and kindred, there are many now suffering from physical injuries as a result of the attacks of the mob, and many others are in a helpless condition owing to the destruction of their means of sustenance. As mayor of Chicago, I appeal to the citizens to subscribe toward a fund for the relief of these suffering people. Subscription may be sent to the mayor's office, City Hall." Okay, wow. Imagine if the mayor of Chicago in 2022, you know, took a special to the New York Times appeal to, you know, to help the Jews of Kishinev. Okay, so you know, everyone should get the credit where credit is due. The mayor of Chicago stepping up on principle to help relieve the suffering Jews of Kishinev. Okay, end parentheses. So the Kishinev pogrom now puts the Jewish problem, quote unquote, on the world map, and it's always lingering in the background. Everybody knows anti-Semitism here and there, and it's a problem, but now it's front and center. And now it's urgent. Our brothers and our sisters and our aunts and our uncles and our cousins are being murdered in Russia, and they have no place to go. So, you know, I'm just paraphrasing Herzl. So help me out. We have to find a solution to this problem. It's not academic anymore. Lives are on the line, and the moment is urgent. There's no, you know, second guessing what we have to do. We have to move this project forward. There has to be some place of refuge to which Jews in distress can flee. So in the aftermath of Kishinev, Herzl presents the Uganda plan. And he does it with a heavy heart. He doesn't want to give up. This is Herzl. He doesn't want to give up on his dream of reestablishing the Jewish state in Palestine. But, you know, looking over your shoulder at what's going on in Russia. So he can't wait for Palestine. He needs an answer to this crisis now. Okay. He's desperate to do something about the Jewish question. And Kishinev makes everything 100 times more urgent. Pogrom becomes a rallying cry for the Zionists. Tens of thousands of Russian Jews began to flee. The plan was brought before the World Zionist Congress. Actually, after Herzl had already died, and I'll come back to that in a second. But ultimately, it's voted on. It's a close vote, but ultimately, it's rejected. You know, they give up on the plan to create a Jewish homeland in Uganda. Okay, let me just pause there and ask if there are any questions about the Zionist congresses, Herzl's attempts to create a charter for Palestine among statesmen, or the Uganda plan, or Kishinev.
Did Herzl ever write about America as a place of refuge?
Which about it was America open. As a place
it was,
of refuge?
Yes, because it was still open at that time.
It was still open. Yeah. Yeah. Not to my knowledge. He did meet with Americans, but I'm not aware of any meaningful plan that he had for America as a place of refuge. Meaning you're right. The immigration, right, goes through the roof, right, in this period, with massive waves out of Eastern Europe to America and to Palestine, right. And again, the numbers are much smaller to Palestine. And I think I've shared with you in the past that some extraordinarily high percentage of Jews who moved to Palestine before World War I leave Palestine because it's so untenable. I forget the number, but it's something like a third of these Jews who actually made Aliyah. They picked up their lives and they left and they brought their family. They moved to Palestine and it didn't go. There was nothing to eat, right? They literally were starving, and it just was an unsustainable environment. They couldn't make ends meet, and they had to abandon their plans to live in Palestine. What I want to share with you now, and I want to take a little time to do it because I think it's so fascinating, and I think it's not well known, is one of Herzl's last attempts, one of his last meetings. This is January 1904, and Herzl died July 3rd, 1904. Okay, so this is just 6 months before he died. He was active till the end, even though ultimately it was a heart condition that killed him. So in January 1904, Herzl attempted to obtain support for the Jewish homeland from Pope Pius X. Okay, and he traveled to the Vatican to meet with the Pope. And he recorded in his diary the whole thing. Okay, we have a whole play-by-play of Herzl's meeting with the Pope. And I want to share with you because I think it is nothing less than extraordinary. Okay. Did I put the whole thing on the source sheet? I think I did. I'm not going to keep it on share screen because I prefer to see your faces. But if you'd like to follow, this is source 13 in your source sheet, straight out of Herzl's diaries. Again, available in your local library, on Amazon, on eBay, in any language you want. Yesterday, I was with the Pope. The route was already familiar since I had traversed it with Lepe several times. Lepe is the count who arranged the meeting. Past the Swiss lackeys who looked like clerics and clerics who looked like lackeys, the papal officers and chamberlains. I arrived 10 minutes ahead of time and didn't even have to wait. Okay, just the attention to detail, and like you're with him. You could feel it. You're with Herzl in this meeting. I was conducted through numerous small reception rooms to the Pope. He received me standing and held out his hand, which I did not kiss. Lepe told me I had to do it, but I didn't. Okay, he wouldn't kiss the Pope's hand. I believe that I incurred his displeasure by this, for everyone who visits him kneels down and at least kisses his hand. This hand kiss had caused me a lot of worry. I was quite glad when it was finally out of the way. He seated himself in an armchair or throne for minor occasions. Then he invited me to sit down right next to him and smiled in friendly anticipation. I began. Okay. And he gives you the Italian. He says, I thank your holiness for the favor of according me this audience. And he said, it's a pleasure, with kindly deprecation. I apologize for my miserable Italian. He didn't speak Italian, and he spoke German, he spoke French, he taught himself a little English, and he learned Italian because he's trying to found the Jewish homeland, and he has a meeting with the Pope, so he learns Italian. I apologize for my miserable Italian, but he said, no, Commander, you speak very well, for I had put on for the first time, on Lepe's advice, my Medie ribbon. Consequently, the Pope always addressed me as Commendatore. He's a good, coarse-grained village priest, to whom Christianity has remained a living thing even in the Vatican. I briefly placed my request before him. He, however, possibly annoyed by my refusal to kiss his hand, answered sternly and resolutely. Okay, it's in the back of Herzl's mind that the whole conversation went awry because he had declined to kiss the Pope's hand at the beginning of the meeting. Okay, he's not sure. So what does the Pope, say? He said, this is in the bold, we cannot give approval to this movement. Right? He says, I want to have a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Pope, what do you think? He says, no, I don't like it. We cannot prevent the Jews from going to Jerusalem, but we could never sanction it. The soil of Jerusalem, if it was not always sacred, has been sanctified by the life of Jesus Christ. As the head of the church, I cannot tell you anything different. The Jews have not recognized our Lord. Therefore, we cannot recognize the Jewish people. Herzl editorializes. Hence, the conflict between Rome, represented by him, and Jerusalem, represented by me, was once again opened up. At the outset, to be sure, I tried to be conciliatory. I recited my little piece about extraterritorialization, res sacre extra comercarum, commercium, holy places removed from business, didn't make much of an impression. Jerusalem, he said, must not get into the hands of the Jews. And its present status, Holy Father? I know, it's not pleasant to see the Turks in possession of our holy places. We simply have to put up with that. But to support the Jews in the acquisition of the holy places, that we cannot do. I'm with you. I don't want the Turks there. I don't want the Ottomans. But the Jews, that would be even worse. So I said that our point of departure had been solely the distress of the Jews and that we desired to avoid the religious issues, right? And again, in Herzl's mind, he's not out to create a religious state. He just wants to create a Jewish state where Jewish refugees can flee so that they're not murdered by the, you know, Cossacks and Russians. And this is the case he's making to the Pope. What does the Pope say? He says, yes, but we as, and I as head of the church cannot do this. There are two possibilities. Either the Jews will cling to their faith and continue to wait the Messiah, who for us has already appeared. In that case, they will be denying the divinity of Jesus, and we cannot help them. Or else they will go there without any religion, and then we can be even less favorable to them. Okay, so it's quite binary. Either you're Christian and we'll be your friends, and then we'll be all together, or you're not, in which case, sorry, Charlie. The Jewish religion was the foundation of our own, the Pope says, but it was superseded by the teachings of Christ, and we cannot concede it any further validity. Judaism is done for, right? It was superseded. The Jews, who ought to have been the first to acknowledge Jesus Christ, have not done so to this day. This is my favorite line from the diary. Look what Herzl's about to say. He says, it was on the tip of my tongue to say, that's what happens in every family. No one believes in his own relatives. But I said instead, what an amazing line. He says this to the Pope. Terror and persecution may not have been the right means for enlightening the Jews. Terror and persecution may not have been the right means for enlightening the Jews. You know, maybe if there wasn't a crusade that, killed my family, we would have been a little more receptive to your religion. So it certainly wasn't helping your cause, Your Excellency, that you've been persecuting us for 2,000 years. He says it to the Pope. But he rejoins, and this time he was magnificent in his simplicity. And I'll just editorialize, by the way. Okay, he's writing this the day after the meeting. He's just been rejected and insulted. And at that moment, crushed as he may have been by the rejection, he's able to maintain this sense of what a guy, and magnificent in his simplicity, which I just think is stunning. But he rejoined, and this time he was magnificent in his simplicity. Our Lord came without power. Era povero. He was poor. He came in peace. He persecuted no one. He was persecuted. He was forsaken even by his apostles. Only later did he grow in stature. It took 3 centuries for the church to evolve. The Jews, therefore, had time to acknowledge his divinity without any pressure, but they haven't done so to this day. So you hear what happens? The Pope says, why haven't you come over to our side? Herzl says, why have you been persecuting us for 2,000 years? And the Pope says, no, it's like only 1,700 years, because for the first few hundred, Jesus was scorned himself and wasn't in a position of power, so we hadn't persecuted you for those first few hundred years, and that would have been the perfect opportunity to accept Christ as your Lord. Since you didn't, I can't help you. How amazing is that? But Holy Father, the Jews are in terrible straits. Okay, so now he's at the end. And he plays his last card. Don't do it because, you think that we're going to be good Christians. Do it because there's human blood being spilled. Holy Father, the Jews are in terrible straits. I don't know if your holiness is acquainted with the full extent of this sad situation, right? Kishinev happened the year before. We need a land for these persecuted people. Help us out. Pope, does it have to be Jerusalem? We're not asking for Jerusalem, but for Palestine, only the secular lands. We cannot be in favor of it. Does your holiness know the situation of the Jews? Yes. Okay, this is the classic Christian answer. I also know Jews from my Mantua days. Jews live there, and I've always been on good terms with the Jews. I have a Jewish account, right? Only the other evening, 2 Jews were here to see me. We're good friends. After all, there are other bonds than those of religion, courtesy, and philanthropy. These we do not deny to the Jews. Indeed, we also pray for them, that their minds be enlightened. This very day, the church is celebrating the fast of an unbeliever who, on the road to Damascus, became miraculously converted to the true faith. And so if you come to Palestine and settle your people there, we shall have churches and priests ready to baptize all of you. As long as you're ready to drink the water, we're good to go, says the Pope. Count Lippe had himself announced. The Pope permitted him to enter. The Count kneeled, kissed his hand, then joined in the conversation by telling of our miraculous meeting in Bauer's Beer Hall in Venice. The miracle was that he'd originally planned to spend the night in Padua. As it had happened, I'd expressed the wish to be allowed to kiss the Holy Father's foot. At this, the Pope made a long face, for I hadn't even kissed his hand. Lippe went on to say that I had expressed myself appreciatively on Jesus Christ's noble qualities. The Pope listened, now and then took a pinch of snuff and sneezed into a big red cotton handkerchief. Actually, these peasant touches are what I like best about him and what compels my respect. Okay, in this way, Lippe wanted to account for his introducing me, perhaps to excuse it, but the Pope said, on the contrary, I'm glad you brought me the Signor Commendatore. As to the real business, he repeated what he had told me, we cannot. Until he dismissed us, Lippe spent some time kneeling before him and couldn't seem to get his fill of kissing his hand. Then I realized that the Pope liked this sort of thing. But on parting too, all I did was to give him a warm hand squeeze and a low bow. Duration of the audience, 25 minutes. In the Raphael rooms where I spent the next hour, I saw a picture of an emperor kneeling to let a seated pope put the crown on his head. That's the way Rome wants it. An amazing account of an amazing episode, which I think is not particularly well known. Again, nothing came of it, but the account itself is so revealing about Herzl, about everything that he struggled for, everything that he hoped for, everything that he asked for, the Catholic Church's total dismissal of any humanity or anything that didn't fit exactly into the Catholic party line. Totally predictable, but so revealing. 1904, July 3rd, Herzl died of a heart condition. In his will, he wrote that he wanted to be buried in Vienna, next to his father, and he wanted to remain there until, you know what he wrote? He said, until the Jewish people will carry my remains to Palestine. Kahava. And so it was. 1949, Herzl was reinterred, not in Palestine, but in Israel, on a mountain which now bears his name, Har Herzl. Okay. Let me say a word about Herzl's legacy, and then I'll leave a little time for any questions and conversations. Okay, so just a little trivia question. What cities in Israel are named for Herzl? Every city in Israel has a street named Herzl, but what cities in Israel are named Herzl?
Herzliya.
So excellent. This is like the question, who's buried in Grant's tomb? So Herzliya. And there's another one. You know the other one?
Theodore, let's see. Not Givat Zev.
Givat Zev, I think, is for Jabotinsky.
Zev is Jabotinsky, right. Okay.
You ready? I can't prove it, but I read this in a couple places.
Binyamina or something. Binyamina?
More famous than that. You ready? Tel Aviv. What am I talking about? What does Tel Aviv mean? Tel Aviv is a rough translation of, first of all, what does it mean? What's a tel?
Mount.
Yeah, a tel is like a mount, but specifically, right, a mount which has accrued over time, right? So the archaeologists always have a tel, and what's underneath, right, is layers and layers of different, strata, different civilizations. So, and what's Aviv?
Spring.
Right. So the tel is old and Aviv is new. And what's Herzl's book? Alte Neuland. So it's the translation, right? It's the translation of Alte Neuland.
Wow.
So next time you're in Tel Aviv, you think of Herzl. I put on the source sheet just so you could see it. Let me see if I have it here for you. It should be the last source on your sheet. So this is just the first couple paragraphs of Israel's Declaration of Independence. There is only one man, only one person named in Israel's Declaration of Independence, and that is Theodore Herzl, right, with reference to the Zionist Congress and to his efforts to bring about a Jewish state. So Herzl was fundamentally responsible for creating the very notion of political Zionism. He emboldened an entire generation to agitate for a homeland in Palestine. And as I think I mentioned in one of the earlier sources, right, he inspired Jews to dream again of returning home. Before Herzl, so you know, you're a refugee, you're running for your life, and you're not thinking of the place you're running to, you're just thinking about the place you're running from. And Herzl gave them a place to run to. Right? He gave them an inspiration and an aspiration that they could return to a Jewish homeland. I'll go back to Stefan Zweig. Okay, the sentiments that I quoted from Stefan Zweig were not his own. He was just reporting what was going on. You know, he said he was in Gymnasium at the time that Der Judenstaat came out, and all of the high society in Vienna is saying, what happened to our friend, our man Herzl? He used to be this reliable, funny, witty, smart commentator in, you know, Der Freie Press and Die Neue Freie Press, and now he turned into this lunatic, thinking about returning to a homeland in Palestine. It's crazy. So Stefan Zweig, you know, ended up befriending Herzl, and they worked together. Upon seeing, you know, Herzl asked for there not to be a funeral. There was a funeral, and thousands of people came. And upon seeing the outpouring of grief, Stefan Zweig wrote the following. He said, "And it was this gigantic outpouring of grief from the depths of millions of souls that caused me to realize for the first time how much passion and hope this lone and lonesome man had borne into the world through the power of a single idea." Okay, I'll share just one other quote. Howard Sacker, who I quoted earlier, who put a lot of these sources together, he said Herzl removed the Jewish problem from the waiting rooms of philanthropy and introduced it into the chancelleries of European diplomacy. There became a political path for the movement to progress where there had not been one before. And of course, we know the continuation of the story from 1904 to the Balfour Declaration, to the partition, to the Declaration of Independence. Let me add a religious Zionist coda, because I'm a religious Zionist. It's so unlikely, right? It would have been so unpredictable, and I started with this, but if you would have said Theodor Herzl, secular Jew, born into a secular family with tragedy all around him, and what are the chances that this is the man that would ultimately be responsible for the birth of political Zionism that led to the establishment of the State of Israel? What are the chances? You know, like, no one could have ever predicted such a thing. And his life and his story is so, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Unlikely. That one cannot help but step back and say, right, this man had to be part of a divine plan. Harbe shluchim lamakom, you know, Hashem has many agents, and sometimes they look one way and sometimes they look another. But this wasn't lost on people like Rav Kook, who saw in Herzl. Right, the sense that he was responsible for ushering in a kind of Mashiach ben Yosef, a pre-messianic period. And he actually said just as much in his eulogy for Herzl. So to say that, you know, he's a harbinger of the redemption almost doesn't do justice to the life and to the accomplishments of Theodor Herzl. But at the very least, I think we could say that. A hero of the Jewish people, who deserves much more attention than two short classes, but I hope I've at least whet your appetite so that you'll continue to read any of the 200 biographies on Herzl or any of the 1,000 pages of his diary, I'm quite sure they will be ennobling and elevating. Let me stop here, and I'm happy to take some questions at this time.